Welcome to our JCC Coffee, Cake, and Learning. Sticks and stones may break my bones, and words will surely hurt me, is the title of this morning's class. We are going to amalgamate themes from last week's sort of Torah reading coming into this week and next week. And it all revolves around speech. Speech. And it shouldn't be a surprise, because we are in the fourth book of the Torah, of the Bible. So it's commonly referred to as the Book of Numbers, because we count the Jewish people more than once. However, if a play on words, if you look at the word which is in the wilderness, Bamidbar, in the desert. But if you take out the vowels, as you know, the Torah doesn't have any vowels in the actual Torah itself, the scroll. You could also read it, not just Bamidbar, in the desert, but Bamidaber, about speech. So those of you who have been to Israel, you would say to somebody, you know, if you're a woman, you say, At midaberet ivrit, do you speak Hebrew? Right? So dibur is speech. So it seems to be on a secondary level that the entirety of the book, or at least a big thematic element of the book of Numbers, is also speech. And then comes up time after time after time. So this morning, I want to talk about evil speech, lashon hara. So before we get into the source materials and the body of the talk, I want to just sort of quote you Torah she'bal peh, oral tradition from the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. Rabbi Gansfried wrote this book called the abridged Code of Jewish Law. And in it he discusses the prohibition of gossiping, evil speech, and outright slander. And he differentiates between the three. Okay? So there's a biblical quote. Here's the biblical quote. Lo teilech rachil ba'amecha. It says in the Torah, in the Bible, that a gossip monger shall not walk amongst your people. A rachil is a gossiper. Now in the old days, what do you think the gossip monger was? He was a peddler. Both a peddler of information, because the peddler would travel from town to town. Psst, psst, ah, did you hear what happened to Chaim and Moshe back in that last little village? And they would be a literal peddler, right? They'd be peddling goods and wares, but they would also be peddling information. Today's rachil, today's peddler, might be known as Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, email. I mean, heaven help us, but we have more and incredibly fast ways to let information disseminate our world than has ever been in human history. And it's both a wonderful thing to have access to information instantaneously, right? If you're a big sports fan and you're not able to, like, listen to the Yankees game, you know, you can watch the game cast and every pitch and every strike, and you can kind of watch the game on your smartphone when you're out at the opera. I'm not sure if anyone's ever done this before, but I'm sure it's, I can picture somebody in the back, you know, in La Boheme at the Met, and they don't want to get in trouble, but they're a huge diehard Yankee or a Mets fan. Sorry about that one, Bruce. And I could picture them in the back of the Met, you know, quietly with their cell phone on mute, watching I don't think they're going to watch the game literally. That would be a little too much of an offense, but, you know, watch it. So we have the ability to transmit information in rapid ways that have never existed in human history. And it's a tough thing to deal with. So we're going to talk about that now. So Rabbi Gansfried explains to us that there are three levels of sin. There is the basic level of gossiping. And then there's the secondary lashon hara, which is more grievous, speaking badly about somebody. And then there's the slander, which, as it sounds, is slanderous. So what differentiates them? So it's interesting. Rabbi Gansfried, and I'll just quote from him in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. I didn't put it on your sheet because I endeavored to keep a one-page clean little source sheet for you. So I didn't choose to include this. But here's what Rabbi Gansfried says. It says in the Torah, Lo teilech rachil b'yamecha. A talebearer, a gossip monger, should not walk amongst your people. What is a rachil? What is a talebearer? He's someone who is toein devarim, who acquires information. Now again, that information could be just parv. It doesn't have to be fleshic or malchic. It doesn't have to be meat or dairy. It's just neutral. It's information. And the person goes, walks from this person to this person to this person and spreads the information about. You know, when you get good information, it's always fun to be the first to disseminate it if it's not injurious and libelous. So that's a rechil. So that is someone who, again, is not trying to hurt another individual. They are rather in possession of juicy gossip, and they want to give the information over. They have no mal intent against anyone or anybody.
Okay. Like Fox News.
It's basically everybody today on the, you know, on the cyberspace getting out there. So that is a rechil. And then Rabbi Gonstry goes on to say, oh, by the way, if you think that this is innocuous, it's innocent, think again. Because there is a source in Navi, in the Book of Prophets, that tells us that a whole city of Kohanim, of priests, was killed because of rechilut, gossip, information. And they tell us a story, I won't go into all the details, but there was a Kohen city called Nov, and the Kohanim there, the priests there, had a young man who was running for his life. His name was David, King David, David HaMelech. And he came there for sanctuary, and he asked the priest to please help him. Now the priests there, the Kohanim in Nov, were absolutely in love with King Saul. They recognized Shaul, King Saul, as the legitimate king. They had no malevolence, if you will, malevolence against the king. But they helped David. They gave him some food. They gave him his old sword that he had used in his battle with Goliath. And they helped him out. And as a result of someone spreading this gossip, a man named Doeg, this vicious character, the Doeg the Edomite that we referenced about King David, who hated King David, Doeg slaughtered all those priests for having helped David out, which, even though it didn't seem like a treasonous action, King Saul ordered the deaths of these people, and Doeg carried it out. So as a result of gossip, the fact that they had helped King David, and again, the priest didn't help King David to contrary the act, you know, in contrary action to Saul's wishes. They just, it was just information that happened. And as a result of information being told, a whole bunch of priests lost their lives.
The act of helping is not gossip.
No, but Doeg telling the information over to the king was gossip.
But he did it with malintent.
He did, but the people who spread the word originally, no. Okay. And had King Saul said to the priests, hey, I heard that you guys had a visitor. They would have said, yeah. And they would have said, oh, well, who's this? And they would have said, well, of course, we helped David. He plays harp for you. You love David. In other words, they had nothing. They had no bone to pick with King Saul. They weren't taking sides in the dispute of who legitimate true king was. No. So even so, it caused the deaths of these people. Okay, that's the bottom level. Torah commandment, prohibition, don't be a gossiper. Then there's a worse sin. Lashon hara. Literally translated, evil speech. And what differentiates evil speech from gossip? One item. They're both true, but whereas gossip has no nefarious intent, lashon hara, evil speech, as its name sounds, like Emperor Palpatine and Star Wars, right? It's the dark side. You have true information, but you intend to injure someone with that information. You weaponize the information. So that's Lashon Hara. And then the third level is out and out slander. What is slander?
Lies.
Lies. Thank you, Carolyn. It's where the information is not even true. You make it up. So you're making up malicious information with nefarious intent, and that is called motzi shem ra, bringing a bad name on someone who didn't earn it. That's the worst of all the three levels of gossiping. So here's an interesting question. How do we see today's society within the confines of Rabbi Gonstry? So I think it's kind of fascinating. So listen to this. He uses the following description to explain to us what is a gossiper. Person who acquires information and walks or goes from person to person.
Hey, hey,
psst, psst, did you hear the latest? And then, when he's describing the next level down, down towards the pit of the abyss, lashon hara, evil speech, listen to Rabbi Gonsfried's words. It's a person who sits and says the following information is true, although it's injurious. So I grew up in a home of newspapers. My father, Allah Shalom, my mother, Allah Shalom, were big newspaper people. They literally published the Jewish newspaper in Vancouver, where I grew up. So I had access to newspapers of every type, Jewish, non-Jewish, every, I mean, it was a big part of our lives. So I'm very familiar that in the old days, before we mished and meshed in a very bad way, reporting and editorializing, I mean, today we don't have honest reporting, as you know. A purist will tell you that the only place a newspaper or a TV or anyone else should put their own feelings is on an editorial page. And they should differentiate and say to you, by the way, this is my editorial take on the events. But everywhere else, there should be an absence of personalization. It should just be information. So what do you call someone who gathers information for a newspaper? A beat reporter. We even have words for it, right? You have a reporter, like the Times Leader or the Citizen's Voice, may have somebody who hangs out at City Hall and the police station and the courthouses, and they look at the dockets, and they have a beat. That's their beat. So that's exactly how Rabbi Gonsfried describes gossiping, that you get information, you're like a beat reporter. You're gathering information. Now that information, in and of itself, has no intent of good or bad. It's parve. It's neutral. It's not milk or meat. Okay, but look at the description Rabbi Gonsfried gives for somebody who is speaking lashon hara with the nefarious intent of that information. So in other words, you've gathered the same information. It's true, but you're disseminating that information specifically to target someone and to hurt someone. He says someone who sits and says the following. What do you often refer to a newspaper's editorial? The desk. You say the editor's desk. That's always a euphemism for the official New York Times, Washington Post opinion, you know? And they always cloak it in as if it's the opinion of the entirety of the organization. Usually it's just one guy writing the editorial, one lady writing the editorial. Be that as it may. So you see that Rabbi Gonsfried nuances how he describes information gathering, gossiping, and then differentiates it from editorializing. And that's a very big thing. We need to know that, because we're going to discuss in a few short moments the spies. And we have to figure out what the spies did wrong. Okay? So let's begin with the story, source one, of lashon hara, of evil speech. So let me give you a little, we don't really need to read from here. I just included it just to have it as a source sheet for your information. So here's the background. Who loved Moses more than anyone in the world? Who created Moses? His sister Miriam. Without Miriam and her heroism, there wouldn't be a Moshe. Moses wouldn't have existed. So here's the backstory. As Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. So in Egypt land, Pharaoh decreed all male Jews and Egyptians, both, shall be cast into the Nile River to the crocodiles. And it was a tough thing. So what happened to the Jewish population of Egypt? They stopped having children. They said, that's it. There's no future. And the head rabbi, love for you, the head, that means to your health in Israel style. Labriut is your good health. Or Gesundheit, as they would say. So Amram and Yocheved, the head rabbi and head rabbitson of all of Egypt land, divorced. Because Amram, the husband, felt, if I am going to lose a child to this nefarious decree to be thrown to the crocodiles, better that I don't have a child. Better we all divorce. So he divorced his wife. The rest of the Jewish men, many of them followed suit because he was their leader. And little five-year-old Miriam, 5 years old, comes to her Abba, says, Dad, you are worse than Pharaoh. Dad, Amram, the head rabbi, says, what do you mean, dear? You are sentencing both boys and girls to death by divorcing mom. Who made you God? We understand we're under this evil, genocidal, maniacal pharaoh. Who are you to decide who is born and who lives and who dies? So you're cutting off any future that Jewish people have by not being with mom. Hmm? And incredibly, Amram, dad, not only doesn't get angry, he heeds his daughter, his five-year-old little Pitzalot's daughter's advice. Amazing. And he brings publicly his wife Yocheved back. They get remarried. And prematurely, 6.5 months later, because Moses was a preemie baby, as they say, Moses is born. They're able to hide him for the couple months because he was born premature. So Miriam is the one who creates Moses. She's the one who, when they put Moses in the basket and they bring him down to the Nile River and they put him in the water, she's waiting nearby on the shore to watch over her little baby brother. So you must admit that if anyone wore the team colors, if Moshe, you know, had a sigil, the Moshe Torahs, you know, number 18, right, for Chai. So Miriam would be wearing the Moshe jersey because she was Team Moses. But listen to what happens years and years later. Miriam hears an offhand remark from a couple of women who are discussing the fact that their husbands are now prophets. I won't go into all the details. But Miriam is there, and who is there also is Zipporah. Now, Zipporah was the eldest daughter of Yitro, and she's the one who marries Moses. If you remember, Moses runs away and saves the seven young ladies at the well, rescues them, and he marries the oldest of the girls, Zipporah. They have two children together, Gershom and Eliezer. But you don't hear much about Zipporah, because what happens? On Mount Sinai, everyone goes back to their wives. All the men and women get back together after the Torah is given. I won't go into all the laws of purity, but they wanted to keep everyone ritually clean, and when a man is intimate with a woman, there's issues of perhaps mikvah that you need to purify someone. So the men and women were apart for a few days, and then they were back together, except one man, Moses. Moses was told, don't go back to your home, meaning, I need you. He's the only sort of monk in Jewish history that from the time Sinai happens, the revelation, he never does go back to become a family man with his own wife, Zipporah. Now, who knew this? Zipporah knew this. Moses knew this. And God knew this. No one else. So Zipporah is listening while these two ladies talk about their husbands becoming prophets. And she makes an offhand remark in the presence of Miriam. She says, oh, I feel sorry for those two ladies, Zipporah says to Miriam. They're going to be widows to prophets, meaning they'll be married in name, but they won't see their husbands anymore, because that was the perspective of Zipporah, and then she walked away. So Miriam is flabbergasted, and she goes to her brother Aaron, another member of Team Moses. This is, you know, Aaron the priest, an amazing human being. And she speaks to Aaron. She says, Aharon. She says, I just found out something horrible. He says, what? Zipporah and our brother Moses are not living as a husband and wife. They're separated. Moses is with God, and Zipporah is a home alone. What's going on? And then she furthers the discussion with Aaron. She says, you know, I don't get it. I understand Moses got the Torah, and he's a Navi. He's a prophet. But Aaron, you're a prophet, and I'm a prophet, and we live normal family lives, you with your wife, and me with my husband. It's not an issue for us. Why should it be an issue for Moses? I don't understand. This is the Lashon Hara, the bad speech, that is so paradigmatic in our Torah that it's called one of the zichiros, things that we must remember. There are certain Jewish people at the end of their prayers, their davening in the morning, say these famous, remember this, remember Amalek, remember Shabbat, the Sabbath, remember Miriam and what she said against Moses. So it's paradigmatic of something we should heed. So Miriam, this is the evil speech. Now, was it true that her little brother Moses had separated? Of course. Did she have malice in speaking it over? Malice? As they say in Yiddish, you ready for a good term? Pumfakert. The opposite is true. Not only did she not have malice, she was the greatest Moses lover in the world. And yet, for all of that, she is punished for evil speech. So as the rabbis say, heaven help us, if Miriam gets punished in the most innocuous way, where her intent of speaking with Aaron was not to disparage or diminish Moses, but was out of a love and a concern for Moses as a family man, like, what's going on? So apparently, when Miriam speaks to Aaron, she speaks it in the presence of Moses. He's right there. So not only is she not speaking behind his back, she's speaking in front of him. So again, what's the accusation? Aaron, you're a Navi, yeah? You're a prophet. Miriam says, I'm a prophet. Remember, it says Miriam HaNaviyah, Miriam the prophetess. So we know she's a prophet. Well, we're both prophets. It's okay for us to be with our husband or wife. How come it's not okay for Moses? Now, Moses was right there. You know what Moses said in his defense? Nothing. Out of humility, he didn't defend himself. Wow. You know who defended Moses? God came to Moses' defense. And God speaks to the two prophets, Miriam and Aaron, and says, wait, now wait a minute, let me get this straight. You're speaking against my guy, Moshe, Moses? Seriously? Do you not understand that if you're a prophet, you're generic? Everyone else in the world that is a prophet, a Navi, they get it in dreams, and it's in a riddle. My communication with them is pretty pathetic. Not so. Bechol Beiti Nemanhu, in all my house of Jewish people, only Moshe, I speak to him, Adaber bo panim el panim. I speak to him face to face. And I don't speak to him in riddles or dreams or in weird, you know, fat cows, skinny cows, the way he communicated with Pharaoh in the dreams. I communicate with him. He has his Verizon God phone. He picks it up and he can initiate a phone call. And I speak to him 24/7. So you guys are generic prophets. How dare you speak against Moshe, my man? Now, why would Miriam and Aaron not be privy to the nature of the uniqueness of Moses? So the Torah says, Vayish Moshe Anav, the man Moses was the most humble man on the face of the earth. He never even told his own sister or brother the level of his own greatness. He never triumphed and lauded it over them. So they were not aware. Miriam was unaware until that moment, until God defends Moses, of the uniqueness of Moses. Wow. What happens as a result? Miriam, who initiated the Lashon Hara, she's the one who spoke it and initiated the conversation, she and Aaron are both punished, but she immediately gets Tzarat. Tzarat is a biblical form. It looked a little bit like leprosy, like a skin disease. And it did exist, but in Miriam, it was like instantaneous. And then Aaron looks at Moshe. Moses is right there and says, Moshe, she's your sister. Please pray. And Moses says five words. Kel na rifa na la. Kel na, please God. Now, rifa na la, please heal her. And instantly, the tzarat, whatever this leprosy-like disease, went away. Miriam was pure, everything was good. But because she had been with leprosy, even momentarily, she had to be chutz l'machaneh. She couldn't be part of the camp for 7 days. So they had to send her away for 7 days. And the reason that there's this correlation between leprosy and speaking evil speech, and it makes a lot of sense. What does evil speech do to somebody? It ostracizes them and diminishes them and isolates them from everyone else. You're embarrassed to be with humans. So that's what we do to the person who speaks. They punish them with the same disease, measure for measure, mita keneged mita. We say, oh, you're going to marginalize and isolate this person, make them feel like garbage. You're going to go outside of the camp for a minimum of 7 days in isolation. Unfortunately, with COVID, we all understand what it means to be in quarantine. So they would quarantine these people for at least 7 days. And every 7 days, they'd have to check in with the Kohen, their neighborhood priest, not Dr. Cohen, but they went to a Cohen Cohen, and he would have to look at them and say, you're either pure or you're not pure. And the purity would be decided because if they repented from their sin of Lashon Hara. So it's a beautiful way, if you think about it, God allowing a person to address sin immediately and not let it linger for the rest of their lives. Okay, so let's examine now what happened with Miriam, because she is paradigmatic, as we said, of evil speech. So the Torah is basically using her because she's the ultimate example of the most innocuous form in history of evil speech. She had no malevolence, no character assassination dreams against Moses. She loved Moses. It was all done with Moses' greatest wishes and greatest heartfelt love for him in her mind. And yet, for all of that, it was still bad. It was still wrong. And it's there in the Torah for us to learn about and to take heed from. But let's analyze that for a moment. What was the issue at hand? Think about it for a moment. What did Miriam not understand? She didn't understand Moses. Had she understood the enormity of her own brother Moses and how great he really was, the fact that the rules of family applied to everyone else in Jewish history except for Moses. So in other words, she was denied the full picture of the reality of her brother, who he was. She thought she knew him. She thought she knew, well, I'm a prophet, he's a prophet, we're no different. Oh yes, my dear, God said, you're very different. So I think that's really the essence of where we're holding at this moment, that we cannot possibly understand another human being. If Miriam doesn't understand Moses, I promise you, you don't understand someone else. How could you? If you don't walk in their shoes, even if you walk in their shoes, you don't understand them, because most people don't understand themselves. Their actions are sometimes inexplicable to themselves. You say, what did you do that for? You're like, you're right, I don't know, I wasn't thinking. So it's impossible, God is showing us with Miriam, to truly speak and understand the subject of your speech. How could this possibly be? It can't be. So therefore, be quiet, say nothing. Don't speak. Okay. Now how does this relate, as we said, thematically, to the spies? So the next couple sources are going to be spy sources. So the spies come in the Parsha right after the little connection of Miriam. The last piece of this week's Torah reading is Miriam and the story I just shared with you. Miriam speaking against Moses. And then next week's Torah reading, if you're in Israel, by the way, they're 1 week ahead of us, because the last day of the holiday of Shavuot was on a Shabbat, on a Sabbath. So we living in exile celebrated that Sabbath as the second day of Shavuot. We read the book of Ruth in synagogue. That was our Shavuot. But that meant that we didn't read the weekly regular Torah reading, which would have been the one we read last week. So the Israel's 1 week ahead for the next few weeks until we do a double. We do a double header to catch up. Oh joy for those who read the Torah. So let's fast forward to the next Parsha, shall we? So the Parsha resounds with us today because we're dealing with the pain and the suffering of what happened in the Parsha. The story of the Meraglim, of the spies. Spies are us. Remember Mad Magazine? They used to have that little cartoon, Spies Are Us. Yeah, yeah, they're very, it was very cute. Spies, spy versus spy, that's it. So here's what happens. The Jewish people are supposed to go from Mount Sinai and the revelation directly without stopping at Go or collecting $200 or going to jail. They're supposed to go to the promised land of Israel. It's just a few days' journey forth. But the people are unsure about the land of Canaan because the Canaanite nations who live there, they're pretty tough. And they're scared. So they go to Moses and they say, Moses, before we enter the land to conquer the land, what say you? Are you open to sending some explorers? Let's spy out the land and see what's going on. Now Moses does not want to send spies, but he agrees to sending 12 very righteous men, leaders of their generation, and he tasks them for 40 days and 40 nights. They will be gathering information from around Israel. So remember we spoke at, at the outset about Rabbi Gonsfried's take on the beat reporter versus the editorial reporter desk. So this is the ultimate reporting. In other words, just as he said, you go from place to place gathering information. That is all those 12 men were tasked with. Did it come to a successful conclusion? No. We basically lost an entire generation of Jewish people because of the sin of the spies. And the sin of the spies is so horrible that until this very day, we are still suffering because of this sin. I'm not exaggerating. There is the saddest day on the Jewish calendar. It's called Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Av. And the ninth day of Av was the night that the spies came back with their original report from the Promised Land. And they caused the people such grief, such anguish at their report, and they bought into this report, that God says, you're not celebrating your impending arrival in the Promised Land of Israel? What? You're reacting like I'm giving you a horrific, calamitous task when you should be celebrating? You're crying for no reason? Okay. Tonight will be designated for all generations as a night of infamy, like Pearl Harbor, that will, for generations, afflict the Jewish people. On that night, the ninth day of Av, and we'll talk about it coming up very shortly, we lost in the future not one, but two temples. They were both destroyed on the ninth day of Av. And there are historical, horrible things that happened on that day, including the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492, happened on Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Av. So it's like that day, marked on our calendar, became one of infamy, designated for tragedy. And Tisha B'Av is really the worst day on the calendar, because we fast for 25 hours. Middle of the summer, so it's the longest fast that you're aware of, and it's hot, and you can't drink, and it's kind of not a good day, right? It's a day of real mourning, national mourning day. In fact, there are many rabbis who believe that we don't need to have a Holocaust Memorial Day, because the Holocaust is subsumed from within that day of the ninth day of Av. We actually have an elegy that we say publicly in synagogue relating directly to the Holocaust. So all these pogroms and inquisitions and crusades and Torah burnings and these horrible things that have happened generationally all are subsumed within the tragedy of the ninth day of Av, which is caused by the evil speech and report that those spies brought back from the land of Israel. So do you think it's consequential? I dare say it has shaped our lives until this very day, what it means to be a Jew. So let's examine what happens. 12 glorious men, righteous men at the outset of their journey, go to the Promised Land of Israel. Only two of them, Joshua and Caleb, are successful in maintaining their fidelity to Moses, who's sending them on the mission, and of course ultimately to God and the Jewish people. They refuse to engage in the slander of the land of Israel. The other 10, for all 40 days and 40 nights, they plot their return message to uproot the goal of going to Israel and keeping the Jewish people in the desert. Now, I'm not going to go, today's not the purpose of our class, to explore what was on the minds of the spies, but suffice it to say, they all had an agenda. Joshua and Caleb somehow were able to be apart from that agenda. In fact, Joshua was never even involved, because they knew that as the star student of Moses, he would never be co-opted to join their nefarious plot. So they didn't even try to recruit him. So you can picture them camping at night around the fire, 11 of them, and Joshua would probably be in the dark over there eating his beef jerky, because he wouldn't be part of the crowd, because they excluded him from their planning. What about Caleb? Now Caleb is married to Miriam. Wow. He's a heroic guy from the tribe of Judah. He's an amazing man. He was part of the 11, but you know what? It was a fake out. All throughout the 40 days and 40 nights, Caleb led them to believe that he, as husband of Miriam, meaning brother-in-law of Moses himself, that he would join them in disparaging the land of Israel. So they were overjoyed. Oh my gosh, he will be the secret weapon to be used against Moses. Who better than his own brother-in-law to get up and put the final nail in the coffin of the vision of Moses and Aaron? Who better than Kalev? So Kalev led them to believe that he would join their plot. All along, he was waiting and waiting for his opportunity to try to stop the plot. And he almost did. He's an amazing hero. He almost stopped the plot, but it didn't work. So what happens? After 40 days and 40 nights, they return. And they were supposed to only return to Moses quietly and report what they had discovered. You know what they did? They set up a media event. There was a dais set up. CNN, Canaan News Network were there. Right? They were all there. The New York Times, the Post, the bureaus, they were all there. And the people were gathered awaiting the report of these men. Joshua was never allowed on the dais because they knew Joshua would give a positive report and say, "We're with God's with us. What are you waiting for? Let's go to Israel." So Joshua was excluded. The 11 get up and the 10 give their report. And then they allow Kalev to give his report. We'll talk about that in a moment. And the 10 say, and we can actually use our little speech. You ready? This is source 4. If you go to the... I'll just read the whole thing. Ready? They went, meaning the spies, and they came to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the desert of Paran to Kadesh. They brought them back a report as well as to the entire congregation. So everyone's there waiting with bated breath for the report of the spies. And they showed them the fruit of the land. They told him, meaning Moses, has said, "We came to the land to which you sent us, Moses, and it is indeed flowing with milk and honey." It's a land with milk and honey. "And this is its fruit. However, the people who inhabit the land are mighty, and the cities are extremely huge and fortified. And there we saw even the offspring of the giant, the Amalekites," who were this bad band of Haman followers. "They dwell in the south land, while the Hittites and the Jebusites, Amorites dwell in the mountainous region. The Canaanites dwell on the coast and alongside the Jordan." So that was their report. And what was the response of the people? What has God done to us? Why did he take us out of Egypt to have us murdered now at the hands of the Canaanites? We can't possibly go into Israel. Let's get a new leader and let's rethink our entire plan. Did they say anything in this dialogue that was untrue? No, not a word. Every single thing they said was true. They quantified the positioning of the different nations. Obviously, they presented it in a way where they would use names of recognizable nations that were kind of scary to the Jewish people to maximize the impact, but it was all true. So the rabbis are really perplexed. Okay, you're going to punish the spies. They're going to die a horrible death, the 10. And the entire generation between 20 and 60, the men only, by the way, because the women didn't go along with it, the age 20 to 60, battle age, military age men, they all kind of wandered around the desert for 40 years until they all were buried in the desert. And then only the new generation got to go into the land of Israel. But what did the spies actually say that transgressed the Torah's prohibition of evil speech, of Lashon Hara? You might say, but Rabbi, we already know that it's using true words with malice of intent that is the definition of... But what did they say? So the rabbis hone in on only one word. Amazingly, they say there's one word that they said that was malicious. And that one word destroyed the entire people, almost the entirety of the Jewish people, and our temples and everything else that we cited. One word did it all. You know what that word was? It's on the fourth line, the last word. However. However. It's the only word they said that was bad. Wow. I'll cite this for you, okay? Rabbi gets up and he speaks for 20 minutes, gives a class. Afterwards, everyone comes over. Rabbi, Yashkaya, great job, nice, inspiring drasha. Yeah. Guy comes over and, you know, someone who's like the know-it-all. I'm sure we don't have that in our shuls, but I'm sure some communities have that person. And the person who's the critic comes over and says, "Rabbi, you know, there's a great talk, beautifully laid out, but have you thought about this and this and this?" Guess what you just did? you just destroyed everything that the rabbi said or did, and you just diminished him and cut him down with one word, but, however. Think about it in your own experience, right? If somebody comes to you and says, you say, well, how was dinner? Oh, it was tasty, it was great. But you know, okay, stop. So now we're getting to the truth, aren't we? Right? Everything was a preamble to soften the blow. But once you say, but, now we get to tachlis, right? Now we get to what I really want to say to you. So that's what happened here. They used truths to shield their nefarious intent. And they get to that little word, but, however. And that word blows up everything that they had said before. That was the word that was an editorializing of what they were saying. And they were never given license by Moses to editorialize, just to information gather. So when they crossed over from being beat reporters, navigating the land of Israel and gathering data, and when they editorialized with that one little word, however, but, that is destructive. That is the essence of manipulation of the people. So that is the word that they cite as the word that destroyed the entire generation. It's amazing. And it really is true. I mean, you hear it in your own experience, with because you think about it and you think of how we speak. And when you get to that word, but, you say, okay, now I'm getting that the other side is going to fall, right? The hammer is going to fall now. Now I get to the essence of what the person really wants to tell me. So it's true. So now we understand that there was an editorialization going on here. Manipulation. But why should Lashon Hara be so horrible? I mean, let's just back up for a moment. We've spoken from the beginning to the end of the class today about how horrible it is to speak these words, and how horrible it is it destroyed all these things historically because of bad speech, and there's three levels of the speech, and be careful, right? But what's the basis for this? So let's end with a little exploration. We have about 5 minutes, and then we'll call it a day. What do we have in this world other than our minds? Nothing. The only thing we have is our mind and the way we perceive things, our perception of people, of things, events. That's all we have. So Lashon Hara, evil speech at its essence, is a metaphorical rape of the human mind. Because I am taking your mind and I am twisting and subtly moving around the parts of your belief system, your faith, your ideals, your values. And if it's done subtly and correctly, meaning bad people do this, the more subtle I move your thoughts and your acceptance of certain things or your doubts start to linger, it is the most destructive force in the world. Because think about it for a moment. How did God create our universe? Now, he's God, so we're anthropomorphizing, okay? But it says, God spoke, Vayomer Vayihior, Yihior, let there be light, and there was light. Every act of creation was an act of speech. What is God illustrating to us? That your entire world, everything you have, that you perceive, is based on speech. And I'm going to illustrate this by using the word speech in every act of creation. So every act of our creation, of our world that we create for ourselves, is predicated on speech. There is nothing else. Speech defines, through education and exposure to everything that we have, how we look at the world, how we see, how we envision things in the world. So if I take your vision of the world, or your vision of a human being, and I corrupt that vision, I am guilty of the most egregious crime possible. I have literally, I hate to use the word raped your mind, but that's the only thing I can think of to illustrate the severity of what I've done to you. We live in a world today where this is an onslaught. I mean, let's look at Israel for a moment, okay? Anything is possible if you ignore context on someone or something, any idea. If you simply look at a picture, a still picture, and say, okay, what does this represent? What's going on here? Look, there's this wall separating the Jewish people from this side to the occupied territories on that side, and they can run up and down that wall with cameras and talk to people and show checkpoints and people going through checkpoints and how hard it is daily life to commute back and forth. All of this is true. Is there a wall? Of course. Are there checkpoints? Yes. Is life great for the people on the other side of the wall? I'm sure it's not. I'm sure there are real issues. Tragedy. Again, that tragedy falls directly on the Arab countries who attacked Israel in 1947-48 and told the Palestinian Bedouin Arabs, because there was no nation yet, leave your homes, get out, we're going to annihilate and commit genocide against the Jews, and then you'll come home, not a problem. And then cynically, instead of taking the Palestinians, I'm using that term just because it's the term everyone uses, and absorbing them into the cultures and into the ecosystems and countries of Lebanon and Syria and Jordan, etc., they kept them in camps. Do you know that 850,000 Jews, men, women, and children, were expelled from Arab lands in 1947, 48, and 49? Guess where they live now? Israel! Israel absorbed every single one of them, naturalized them, gave them citizenship, and the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of these Jews, who, by the way, were never given any type of compensation for their lives being stolen from them in the Arab countries, they now make up the majority of Israel's population. Because Israel took these refugees, and instead of putting them in camps to manipulate these poor people, they absorbed them. Now, again, it's a horrible situation having these refugee camps. Like, you know, 75 years after Israel's creation. It's insane. Okay? But that's another class. But if I show you that wall and I say, oh, I remember South Africa. Whew. This is an apartheid wall. Just look at it. Look what the Jews do. They separate themselves. It's apartheid. Now, I lived in South Africa. I actually know what apartheid is. I lived there for a short time. It's really horrible. This is not apartheid. So I would dare say to somebody who throws that canard at me, I would say, can I show you another picture? You show me the wall. Beautiful. Now I'm going to show you a picture of Zabaro's Pizzeria in 2001. And the last recovering person died this past week. It's been now 2001, so it's been 22 years. She was in a coma. She just passed away. She was on a life support for 22 years, a young lady, Nakama, an American citizen who was part of the suicide murderous attack on Zabaro's Pizza in the middle of the day, where men, women, and children were just blown apart. So I would show you the intifada that took place from the early 2000s and the 2,000 dead Jewish people from all around Israel, the Passover Seder in Netanya, were blown apart, and the Zabaro's Pizzeria in the middle of Ben Yehuda Mall in Jerusalem. And I would say, you know that wall over there that you point to? This is the context for why that wall was a necessity to make the life even possible for the Jews of Israel. But again, if you ignore context, and I just show the wall, well, pictures don't lie. Facts on the ground don't lie. Or do they? So I could manipulate public opinion in any way I want, any shape or form. And I don't think there's any country on earth who has been more subject to the Lashon Hara, slanderous, libelous type of spies are us that went on in the Torah. And they're not even using the word but or however anymore. They're very proud to come out and tell them, you know, what they feel about Israel, what they feel about Jews as a secondary product. So this is a very real idea. And again, do I have an easy answer? I don't. I wish I did. But we'll leave with this final thought. If words have the ability to injure and to destroy a life because I'm manipulating someone's mind, what if I use words to build someone up in the same way that they can build someone down and strip away and destroy creation? Words can create. And one nice little word to somebody who's in need of solace, of a hand out or a hand up, or just a word of comfort or a good morning. One word can make someone's day and can create someone's life. So there's a duality. So if we will start to use our words and use the lessons of the Torah and invert the lesson and use words instead of Lashon Hara, Lashon Tov, use those words in a beneficial way, in a good way, to uplift and to empower people. Think of what we could do with our world. Think of the possibilities for our world. And I'll leave you with a little story. I know one or two of you here have heard the story, but it's an amazing story. There was a Jewish man, a rabbi, kind of a rabbi, but he was a mashgiach. He's a kosher supervisor, and he was working up in Finland at a fish packing company. I'm guessing it might have been Herring or something like that. It was a huge factory, giant factory. And he, at the end of the day, went down into the bowels of the basement. It's a huge complex. And he was checking on something, and it was after hours, and he walked into one of the coolers, and the cooler shut behind him. And then he realized, oh my gosh, the cooler is like at, you know, 21 degrees or whatever was kept, you know, hermetically sealed for the fish, and there wasn't a way out. They normally keep it unlocked and open during the day, and it was after hours. And the rabbi went, and he started eating. There was an age before cell phones, and even if he had a cell phone, you're not going to get a cell phone connection in the bowels of a basement behind, you know, 3 feet of steel. And he started to pound, but again, he's inside this almost like a prison, like a tomb. So no one's going to hear him. No one's going to check on him. And he realizes, I'm going to die. There's no way out. I'm going to get hypothermia, and they're going to find my dead body in the morning. And he sat down. He started to pray. What else could he do? 20 minutes later, the freezer door opens. And the night security guard sees him. Rabbi, there you are. He takes him out. He's shivering. He's like, you know, can't even talk. He warms him up. And the guard's looking at the rabbi. He says, Rabbi, thank God I found you. The rabbi is blown away. How is it possible that you found me? The man says, Rabbi, you don't understand. I work in this factory. I've worked here for years. And I'm like a wallflower. Every morning people come in, they walk by me like I don't even exist. And every evening when they leave, I don't exist. You're the only person who every morning when I walk in, you look at me in the face, in the eyes, and you say good morning. You see me as a human being. And every night when you leave, you never fail to look at me and say good night and see you in the morning. I got my good morning this morning, but before I left today, I realized that I hadn't had my good evening. I went looking for you. Have a wonderful day, everyone.